We live in a society that has an enormous amount of freedom. We have freedom of speech, we have the right to assembly, and we're here obviously under that right today. We can own property, and as a result, we also have a right to privacy. We can travel, we can choose what we want to do, and we can choose where we want to live. We also have freedom of religion. Obviously, that's very important to us. In fact, we almost have more freedom than we can stand. We also have the freedom to sin. Now, our society holds that last freedom very close. They don't state it in those words, obviously, but I got up this morning and began to read the paper, and Cal Thomas had an editorial in this morning's paper I read through, and he says, what happened to old-fashioned moral values? And he said, they're history, they are gone. He said, in that sense, it's over. And then he went on to make a rather remarkable statement because he said, the problem is not in our leadership. You see, that's where you and I would like to place the blame. He said, the problem is among the citizens themselves. And think about that. Think about how things would change if President Clinton's job approval rating was 20% instead of 60 or 70. He said, the problem is not ultimately with the leadership, it's with the citizens themselves. We often blame our leaders for our problems, and I think there's plenty of blame to go around, but Cal Thomas said, the reason there has been no positive change at the top is because of the values of the citizens themselves, the values environment has changed. And then he gave a couple of examples. He gave an example of a city in Maryland where there was a brothel running right there in the middle of the community, and individuals had been coming and going for quite some time. The woman who ran it was earning $120,000 a year running this operation in the midst of a residential area. And the neighbors finally got fed up, not with the fact that they had a brothel as their neighbor, but because some of the clients were actually parking in their reserved parking spaces. And so they called the police. He then gave a story of a South Carolina theater owner who was trying, in his words, to do the right thing. And he stopped showing R-rated movies in his theater in Spartanburg. And he thought, well, maybe the faith and values crowd will then come in and reward me with their patronage. They'll watch the movies that I have to show. He says they didn't. He lost $20,000 at his 7-screen theater since he instituted the policy last August. After 1 month, his audience dropped from 2,000 to 1,200. Profits were off 50%. He says the whole thing left me rather cynical. He restored the R-rated flicks and concluded you can't make people want something they don't want. Now what was interesting was that his own motives were rather mercenary as compared to rather pure, because when the finances weren't there, he gave the people what they wanted anyway. And then Cal Thomas says, since the problem is not at the top but among the citizens, any restored sense of virtue will not come from the top but from the bottom. He says, we will only notice it after millions of unseen decisions are made to live differently. Millions of unseen decisions are made to live differently. Government can affirm right decisions, but it cannot make them for people. No analysis can absolve the people themselves of responsibility for the quandary we appear to be in. The sins of the fathers are being visited upon the next generation. He says that is why even if politicians promise to do something about our moral failings, they're likely to be confronted by masses of people who prefer their parking spaces to shutting down a house of prostitution in their neighborhood, or who secretly prefer the R-rated films to the milder fare to which they only give lip service. Now, even in the churches of God, the argument has seemingly been over government from time to time, when I believe it should have been more on personal responsibility, should have been more on character and integrity, and not just the character and integrity of our leaders, the character and integrity of you and me. It is our marriages, it is our relationships, it is our children, the way that we have raised them, that determines the character of the church. I talked to a minister this past week in United, who said that he had some new people visit his congregation. And he befriended them, and they kind of built a relationship, and they attended for a time. He said they described to him one time what his congregation was like. They said that the people were polite, but not friendly. They were polite. They said that they were kind, but not real personal. When a contention in the congregation over government was expressed, they got up and walked right back out the door. Who was it that said, "We have found the enemy, and it is us"? You know, we can look at our leaders, we can look at the nation's leaders, we can look at anybody we want. We better stop and take a good hard look at ourselves. We get used to the way things are, and sometimes we forget where it is that we've already been. I graduated from high school in 1969, and I lived at home that summer after graduation. And I remember one time, simply in conversation in my home, 1969, I used the term shacking up as a reference in conversation, and I was literally threatened with removal from the house. It was, if you're going to speak like that in this house, you get your bag and baggage and you move out the door. And I had to literally stop and apologize to my own mother because of how strongly she took that. Now, I realize 1969, that wasn't a cross-section of society, but that was a remnant of the conservative society that used to be, the sexually conservative society that we used to live in. 7 years after that, Jimmy Carter was running for president. He was a very religious man. He is. He's a very sincere religious man. Because of his religious convictions, and because he was running on a platform of moral character, he was interviewed, and in the interview they asked him if he had ever lusted after a woman other than his wife. Now, that was a shocking question back then, frankly. Probably would be more commonly received today, but he answered it anyway. And he admitted that he had indeed had, at times, lust in his heart. Just the thought, the emotion of lust actually entered into his own mind. And do you know what happened when that was publicized? He dropped 15% in the polls in 1 week. From even admitting that he had thought about it, the public began to reject him, and he was concerned that it might even cost him the election. Times have changed. Society has changed. And you and I have changed as well. And it's the you and I that really counts, because that's where we have control. We can be shocked at what swirls around us because someone else is immoral, because someone else has lied or someone else has stolen, but we also have to look into our own hearts, as Jimmy Carter did publicly in that case. We strive to do the right things, but we don't always do them. Even God's own people are not always responsive to God. Think about that. We look in the Bible and we see things that people did and we say, how could they do that? What if you and I were in the Garden of Eden? Here's God, you know, working with us directly, talking to us, absolutely no question about who he really is. And then we have to choose to eat from one of the two trees. I noticed our children in Sabbath school came out with a picture of the two trees. The one tree was smiling and one tree was frowning. And it was about making choices. But if we had to choose then between the two trees, which one would we choose? And we can say, oh, I would do it right. I'm sure I would. If we had just come out of slavery in Egypt and we had seen all of those great miracles of God, and then we had been told to go up and occupy the land of Canaan, would we have gone up? If we had stood in the crowd before Pontius Pilate as a member of the Jewish nation, would we have called for the release of Barabbas or the release of Jesus Christ? As I said, in the back of our minds, we tend to think, well, how could they have done those things? How could Adam and Eve actually be right in the presence of God and not obey him? How could Israel come out of Egypt and see those miracles and not trust God? How could the Jews actually call for the death of Jesus Christ? And yet each and every one of us makes choices every day that in principle are no different than these. We choose between good and evil, blessing and cursing, right and wrong. The choices that we make on a daily basis are not fundamentally any different than those we see biblically addressed. In Ezekiel 28 and verse 14, There's a passage here that is a reference to the king of Tyre, but prophetically it also points in and shows Lucifer, and it makes a reference to something that no earthly king could ever have fulfilled. Ezekiel 28, verse 14. You are the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways, and from the day you were created until iniquity was found in you. Satan did not create freedom of choice. He was just the first one to exercise it. Sin did not exist until he sinned that first time. But the choice of whether or not to sin always did. Notice verse 16. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. Therefore I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. By the abundance of your trading. How is Babylon portrayed? As a great merchant trading empire. Because it is Satan's way. And it is all around us. It is absolutely saturating in the society that we live. Satan became competitive. Satan sought selfish advantage. He began to promote himself. He began to trade for advantage, to get the best out of someone else, to raise himself up over them. And it was sin. Why is it so necessary that we have the right to sin? Why did God create us like that? Even a young child at a very early age has to begin to choose between good and evil. When he is born, that's not an immediate choice, but at an early age, he has to begin to choose whether to respond to mommy and daddy or not, whether to do as he is being shown and instructed or to not. We have a responsibility to prepare our children for God, and God gives us instruction as to what part of that responsibility would be. In Proverbs 22, there is a comment that is made in the midst of the chapter here in verse number 6. It says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Train up a child in the way he should go, and that should set him on course. Now, the word train here in the Greek means to narrow. And the concept is you narrow a child's choices at first. And you only let him choose of those things of which he can afford to. But as he grows up, we have to back off and open that option. And that child ultimately has to choose for himself. God doesn't stop us from failing. He doesn't stop us from making mistakes. He doesn't stop us from marrying someone we shouldn't, or doing something we shouldn't, or being something we shouldn't. He does not stop us, because that is in the parameter that he gave us to choose from. Deuteronomy 30, verse number 11. Moses here is very near his death. And so he lays out now, by God's inspiration for Israel, what it is that they must now choose to do. Deuteronomy 30 and verse number 11, this commandment which I command you today, it says it's not too mysterious for you, it's not far off, it's not like you can't understand. He says, I'm going to make it perfectly clear. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us and bring it to us that we may hear it. It's not beyond the sea. He says, don't even imagine that you don't know what it is you need to do. He says, the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. You know how many times we wander around in our own mind and say, what will I do? What will I do? I don't know what to do. Usually it is because we're choosing from too many choices, quite frankly, or we're allowing ourselves the luxury of having a choice that shouldn't even be there. You do what is right. You do what is good. You do what is pure. I have set before you today life and good, death and evil, in that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, keep his commandments, statutes, his judgments, so that you can live, really live, not just have more years, but that your life will have meaning and purpose, value, so that you can live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land where you go to possess. But if your heart turns away so that you don't hear, and you're drawn away and worship other gods or other things or other philosophies, other values, and serve them, I announce to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to go in and to possess. Not only will God not be on your side, but you will live a living death. You will surely perish. Verse 19, I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life that both you and your descendants may live. This is all that God has ever done over and over again. It is the two trees. It is Israel. It was Adam and Eve. It was David as the king. Making choices. Making choices as to how we will respond to and serve God. In the book of Joshua, chapter 24, this is brought to the people as a reminder, because now Joshua is about to die. And as he goes on, he basically says, you know, I don't want you to blame the leaders, and I'm dying, and I'm not going to be here, and you won't be able to kick me around anymore. You know how that goes. And he says, this is your responsibility. This lies on your shoulders. In that sense, brethren, the church is what we do, not what somebody else does. Our congregation is who we are and how we respond and how we relate and nothing else. In Joshua 24, Joshua goes through and he reminds the people of how God called Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and he brought them out of Egypt, eventually their descendants, and how he brought them into a land, and he sent hornets before them and drove the people out of the land, and how God had intervened and done so very, very much to set them up. And in verse 13 says, I have given you a land for which you did not labor, cities for which you did not build, and you dwell in them, and you eat of the vineyards and the olive groves which you did not plant. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, Joshua said, we will serve the Lord. All we have ever had to do, by even our own creation, as God designed, is to choose. Over and over again, we choose. That's what God's purpose is. That we have the freedom to sin is God's purpose. Because if we cannot choose to do evil, then neither can we choose to do good. And if God was to, say, intervene to remove evil from the earth, where would He draw the line? Well, surely He would get rid of genocide, millions of people wiped out, nationalities destroyed. Surely God would do that. Well, why not stop murder altogether? I mean, why should we have anybody perish by murder? Well, you know, torture is not a very good deal. God surely would stop torture. Well, what about a slap in the face? Maybe that's not very good either. And, well, how about a harsh word? Isn't that where it starts? What about cheating on a test at school? What would he then do to resolve the problem? Well, one thing he could do, if one area was particularly bad, say worse than other areas, and tended to affect areas around it, he could rain down fire and brimstone and destroy just that area and get rid of them, and that would stop evil, right? Well, it didn't work very well in Sodom and Gomorrah. It was just kind of a momentary adjustment. Of course, if it was evil was very pervasive and over all the earth and everywhere, what he could do is he could bring a flood and he could just pull a few people aside and start over with a righteous head and then wipe out everybody else, and that would wipe out evil. But it didn't, and it won't. How far would God have to intrude himself into our lives to stamp out evil? He would have to assert absolute, total, and continuous control. We would have to become robots under His direction and His power to totally wipe out evil from the creation. What kind of relationship with Him would we then have? Would you marry a little baby, a child, someone whom you had to exercise complete control over, someone you had to do everything possible for, someone you had to watch everything they did? What kind of family would God have without free will? You see, we have responsibility to make those choices ourselves. We have the freedom to do so, but the responsibility that follows. John 16, verse 32, refers to Christ here, near his own death, reflecting, talking to the disciples about what the circumstances are, and he said, "Indeed, the hour is coming, yes, has now come, that you will be scattered each to his own, and will leave me alone, yet I am not alone. The Father is with me. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." John 16:33, "I have overcome the world." He didn't just say that he overcame Satan. Satan is the god of this world, and that is part of it. But even without Satan, there would still be evil, and it would be created and produced exactly the way he did that very first time, by you and by me. Christ overcame the world, and he overcame his own flesh. Christ had been hot, he'd been cold, and he'd been hungry and tired and wet and sore and thirsty. Christ had been laughed at, lied to, threatened and betrayed, and now as he went into the time of his crucifixion, they would slap him and kick him and beat him and spit on him. And his body and mind had to absolutely cry out for relief from that, and yet he never sinned. He was never selfish. He never failed. All through that, his focus was always one of outgoing concern for others. Now, Satan may play on the desire of our flesh to be satisfied, but our flesh cries out quite sufficiently all on its own. All during the millennium, Satan won't even be there, and people will still have to overcome the pull of the flesh. What does God do in Zechariah 14 when the people are not obeying him in Egypt and he wants them to keep the feast? Does he reason with them a little bit, say, "Oh, please, you know, come over here and visit with me"? Or does he withhold the rain? He doesn't just reason with their minds, he reasons with their stomach as well. This flesh has a pull all its own. During the millennium, when Satan isn't even around, men and women will still be attracted to each other. Children will still have to learn to be obedient to their parents. Parents will still have to learn to be patient and loving with their children. All of mankind will still have to learn to be obedient to God, and that has nothing to do necessarily with Satan. That has to do with this flesh. Overcoming the world has far more than just overcoming Satan. It's overcoming what we actually are. With Satan removed, there will still be much to overcome. Galatians 5 addresses that in a principle. Galatians 5, verse number 16. "I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh." Satan can come in and tweak that. He can make that much more obvious and evident, but it's there. It's there all by itself. "You shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. We are designed and built and prepared that way by creation." Sooner or later, a baby will want to be fed. And if you do not feed him, he'll probably say, "Oh, please, feed me. Please, quietly, gently, softly," he'll say, "feed me." I don't think so. Our flesh cries out and desires to be responded to. The human condition, man in his natural state, is, I think, probably best described by the word self. Focus on self. That was all the human condition knows. And it's only in responding to God that we learn to be selfless. To be God-like means to be less the self. Hebrews 5. Christ suffered many, many things, and in his suffering, he learned. There were lessons, there were perspectives, there was depth of understanding, there was degree of personal identity that he learned in the course of that. Hebrews 5, verse number 5. Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Christ did not even lift himself up, but he let the Father do so. And he also says in another place, "You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear, he cried out desperately, fighting against his own flesh and his own desire so that he would not succumb to it. Though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered." Every single time there's a fork in the road, we make a choice. Or as Cal Thomas said, millions of unseen decisions are what lay the basis for the social fabric of this nation. Millions of decisions. It is you and it is me. Don't get caught up in feel-good Christianity. Feeling good is not the same as doing good. This last Monday after the Portland weekend, we had a young adults conference. They had a conference on Saturday night, and I don't remember the exact, it was Sunday night, and I wasn't there because I was finishing my own preparations, but as I understood, there was something like 60 young adults that were there for the conference, and a remarkable group. They wanted to learn. They wanted to be taught. They wanted to participate. They wanted to prepare themselves for service in the church. It was exciting to see that. And then on Monday, we followed through with a full day of classes as well. And I gave a class on the overview of the New Testament. And one slice of that class, a little tiny segment, was the impact of Gnosticism on the New Testament. Now, I know when we use the term Gnosticism in the church, it kind of just goes right over the top in many cases because it's a rather large issue. But I only want to say that Gnosticism was a philosophy of the day in the time of Christ. It was something that affected the way people thought religiously. It was the way they lived their lives. It was all of these things. It was affected the educational system, the value system. Now, my point is not to explain that, but then I asked the class that was there gathered, and I said, "What is an equivalent, all-pervading philosophy of our day? What is it that underlies our social fabric, our religious institutions, our government, our philosophy of morality and such? What is it?" And someone said, "Well, evolution." I said, "Bigger than evolution. Related, but bigger than that. The philosophy that underlies our society today is materialism. He who dies with the most toys wins." Feel-good Christianity is religious materialism. It's a fraud. It's not true. It's not what God created and designed. The fruit of the Spirit is indeed joy, but it's not the joy just from pleasure. There is a joy that also comes from sacrifice and from trials and from service. James talks about that joy, and he says, out of that joy, or in relationship to that joy, we build patience and we build wisdom. And we build faith. The society that tells us to choose the easy, the fun, the enjoyable, the most self-satisfying is lying to us. And yet those are choices that we make every single day. And it is no different than Adam and Eve, or than Israel, or than all the rest of those we see biblically in history. And we say, how in the world could they have done that? If you could write up our lives and print them in this book, and then line up this cast of characters to read, do you not think they would say, how in the world could they have done that? I'm sure it would read not much different in many ways. In the book of Genesis, chapter 3, we see that test that Adam and Eve went through in verse 6. And it quantifies what it was that she chose to do. You can say, God says, don't, I'm going to do it. It quantified it in terms of issues. What were the issues that went through her mind when she chose to disobey God? Genesis 3, verse 6. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and that it was a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. It was good for food, pleasant to the eyes, desired to make one wise. Now, Satan did not create those conditions. He only played on them. With or without Satan, those conditions would still exist. Now, 1 John 2, this is you and me in 1 John. This is our present age and circumstance. And so, I just want to show you how closely parallel it is, and that some things honestly never do change. 1 John 2 and verse 15, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world," Christ said, "I have overcome the world." Forget Satan. I mean, don't forget him. He's an enemy and an adversary. But I'm saying, in terms of what is the bottom line is you and me. "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh," it was good for food. "The lust of the eyes," it was pleasant to the eyes. "And the pride of life," it was desired to make one wise, "is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever." What John wrote about did not change one degree from what Adam and Eve themselves faced. Taking on Satan's nature is a choice, but unfortunately, it's one that we too often readily make. Choosing God's nature goes against the grain of even our ordinary physical flesh, even the way we exist on our own. When Esau came in dragging from the field, from being out hunting or whatever it was that he had been doing, and he came in to his brother, and he asked for food and for provision to satisfy that logical, rational need of the flesh, do you not think? And in Genesis 25 is the account. And he traded his birthright. It says he despised his birthright, but he traded it for a piece of bread and a bowl of lentil soup. And we say, how could he do that? He did it because he was hungry, really hungry. And when he was asked, well, give me your birthright, he says, look, what do I care about my birthright? I'm going to starve. I'm going to faint. I want some food. Feed me now. You can have what you want. What do I care? And his birthright was traded away. He despised it to satisfy the flesh. Now, we can understand that at a time of great and serious need that the flesh would demand satisfaction, we would say, that's fine. But at what price? He traded his future to satisfy his present need, and that is no different from what you and I do every day, except in scale. We're taking little baby steps day by day, and he took a whole huge swath and sent it out the door in one package. Every time we choose to sin, and I say choose to sin, if we are not personally responsible for our sins, then we cannot even repent. If they are blamed on someone or something else, then we cannot even repent because we have yet to take responsibility. It's not our leaders. It's not the God of this world. It's us. The enemy is us. Every time we choose to sin, every time we neglect our responsibilities, we momentarily turn our back on our future. The creation is designed to give us a response to those choices that we make. It's designed to give us immediate feedback and results, to make us show our hand. Some things are created clean, and some things are unclean. Some things are pure, some things are toxic. Some things are good, and some things are bad. And when you choose to partake of them, there is a response. There is feedback. Sometimes the feedback might not fully set in for 20 or 30 years, but there is feedback just the same. All of creation is designed to force us to make a choice. And then it gives us a measure back almost instantly in many cases of what the fruit of that choice is. Some things are good and bad. Fire. It's great to cook your food, to heat your home, to drive your car, but it will also destroy your home and your food and your car and us as well. It has to be used within a very careful set of limits. We lived in Omaha, Nebraska, some years back, and that's the great Midwest, and there were fields and farms everywhere and on every hill. And fertilizer brought much of the increase that was coming off of those farms. But fertilizer also poisoned the water in many of those areas. I remember pulling into a rest area off of the highway, the interstate there, and maybe now that I think about it, it could have been the highway that it was actually on the other side of the river, the Missouri, as it came down through there. But there was a rest area off the road, and there were signs as you drove in, don't drink the water. It had been poisoned by the agricultural runoff in the area entering the water table, and you couldn't drink the water in that area. You had to bring it yourself. And a member of the church at that time went out and wanted to buy a little farm, and he was really excited. He found the one he liked. He fell in love. He wanted to make an offer. He just made it contingent on one thing, that he could test the water first and make sure it was pure. And when he tested the water, it wasn't, and he couldn't buy it, and he turned and walked away. Because you couldn't live there and drink the water that was under your feet. Some things are good and bad. You can raise a lot of crops on the side of a hill. There's a lot of wheat growing right up south of us. You've got to plow the grass off, though, to do that. And in the course, if you're not careful, you can wash a lot of topsoil out to sea. There's feedback in everything that we do. You can mine the gold and silver out of these mountains, especially the Silver Valley and the sides there out of Coeur d'Alene that has been so famous for so long. But you can also poison the lakes and the streams. When we lived in Texas, you could pump a lot of water out of the aquifer that was under the ground, but because it was dropping every year, you simply couldn't do it forever. You can cut down a lot of trees within a certain limit or a range. There are places I've read about where there was jungle canopy, and they came in and they clear-cut the jungle and actually changed the entire climate of the area by clear-cutting jungle canopy. And the area became arid and dry. And what was once jungle canopy and mush and moist and animals and whatever bugs were hiding in there as well. I guess everything's not a total loss. Everything we do is a choice. Honey's good, but too much honey makes you sick. The sun's good, but too much sun gives you cancer. Too much sleep gives you creditors. The creation is designed so that many of the choices we make set off a kind of chain reaction. And we become accountable. You don't have to wait for God to intercede and show us our hand. It's already shown. It's shown when you look at your fields. It's shown when you drink your water, when you look at the house. It's shown when you look at your children and your family and your own personal life. Again, we don't need to focus on the leaders or on Satan or on all these things around us. We really need to focus on ourselves. God designed His creation to give us feedback. I lived in New Mexico for a time. You know what happens when you kill off all the coyotes? The rabbits propagate. Of course, rabbits don't eat calves, they just eat the grass. Either way, you've damaged the environment in a significant way. You can drain off the swamps and you can kill the mosquitoes, but you also destroy the birds and the fish, and along with the water course that feeds us. They have drained off something like 50% of the Everglades from its ultimate extent, and now they're having some serious problems with the areas that they moved into with agriculture and other things because the water base, therefore, is gone. Everything we do is interrelated. Grasshoppers and locusts. Have you noticed in the Bible that when there's a drought, there's grasshoppers and locusts? Well, you'd think it would be the opposite. If there was a drought and there wasn't anything as much to eat, you'd think the grasshoppers and locusts would die like the rest of us. But you see, when there's rain in due season, there's a mold that gets on the eggs of the grasshoppers and the locusts, and they don't all hatch out. And so rain in due season is actually a blessing from God that also keeps them down and under control as well. But when there's a real dry season and a drought, those eggs come through perfectly fine, and they all hatch out, and you have swarms. And so one crippling disease brings another. One mistake brings another mistake. And it's just a chain reaction that sets up through all of the creation. God made it that way, and he put us in the midst so that we would know what happens when we make a choice. Why? Because the ultimate choice is between the two trees. The ultimate choice is between life and death, blessing and cursing. And all through the Bible, time and time again, God says, choose life. And all that around us reinforces that, if indeed we would only see that it is there. God wants things to happen to us in such a way that it reinforces our recognition that we are dependent on him. He has even worked with nations in just exactly that manner. Deuteronomy 11 is interesting in this regard. Deuteronomy 11. God put Israel in the land of Canaan. And it was a very specific spot that he had prepared for them so that they would get cause and effect in their life right up front. And notice this, Deuteronomy 11, verse number 8. Therefore you shall keep every commandment which I command you today, that you may be strong and go in and possess the land which you cross over to possess. And that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore to give your fathers, to them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt, from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. Do you know why Egypt was able to constantly have such an incredible ongoing pagan influence? And do you know why they were constantly able to snub their nose at God, no matter what happened almost? Because the Nile River flowed right down through the middle of their country from half of Africa behind them, and there was always water as much as they wanted, no matter what. Whether they sinned or whether they obeyed, whether they were good or whether they were evil. It says here they could water their gardens by their feet as to pump it out of the Nile River and draw ditches and canals back as a vegetable garden. God didn't put his people in the land of Egypt because he wanted cause and effect. He did not want them to ignore him and disobey him and not realize that that was a problem that was immediate and severe. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven. God had to give them the rain. He had to give them the increase. A land for which the Lord your God cares. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And if God ever took his eyes off of it, they were out. And so he put his people where they would be dependent on his mercy for their success. Why? So that they would make the right choices. Are we receiving the early and latter rain in our own lives? Or are we overrun with grasshoppers and locusts? Our allegiance to God is reflected in many of the millions, as Cal Thomas said, of the very mundane choices that we make every day. Every time we turn on the radio or the TV, every time we go to school or to our job, when we choose our friends, when we teach our children, and when we do not, we teach them just the same. It's what we eat, it's what we wear, it's what we think. It is who we are. Those millions of little decisions reflect indeed our allegiance to God. Revelation 22. Revelation 22 gives reflection here on what God has set before us and what our responsibility is and how important that is in verse number 12. Christ says, behold, I am coming quickly. My reward is with me to give to everyone according to his work. I am the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. I am what there is. I am all there is. Materialism means nothing to me. You know, it's stunning to me that I in my life look out and I see the material things of my life or the church, and I can stop and measure how much value I have put in those as well, and the encouragement I have taken sometimes from the increase of those things. And you know, God just doesn't care about that at all. The Jews thought they would never go into captivity because they had the temple. And they were threatened one time, and right up to the walls of the city, and the army was destroyed and turned back, and they thought, God has protected his temple. And that wasn't the lesson God wanted them to learn at all. Because that temple, unless it serves his purpose, means nothing to God. And neither does the size of the church or the income of the church or the structure of the church in the sense of we taking encouragement by those physical things. God is not bound by those in any way. Verse 14, blessed are those who do his commandments. What Perry was talking about. Those who actually do this, live this. Those who make those choices for the right reasons and go forward in God's service. Blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the gates to the city. Outside are dogs and sorcerers and the sexually immoral and murderers and idolaters and whoever loves and practices a lie, and they better be outside and not inside, because this is us. I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things in the churches. I am the root and offspring of David, the bright and morning star. And the Spirit and bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. And let him who thirsts come. And whoever desires, let him take of the water of life freely. Choose life. God has set before us good and evil, life and death. We want to be sure we are choosing life.